Chapter 18. Individualized by incidents in which S.E. had taken some share. She suddenly thought one afternoon, when looking in the glass at her fairness, that there was yet another date, of greater importance to her than those, that of her own death, when all these charms would have disappeared. A day which lay sly, and unseen among all the other days of the year, giving no sign or sound, when she annually passed over it, but not the less surely there. When was it? Why did she not feel the chill of each yearly encounter with such a cold relation? As he had Jeremy Taylor's thought, that some time in the future those who had known her would say, "It is the day that poor Tess Derbyfield died," and there would be nothing singular to their minds in the statement. Of that day, doomed to be her terminus in time through all the ages, she did not know the place in month, week, season, or year. Almost at a leap Tess thus changed from simple girl to complex woman. Symbols of reflectiveness passed into her face, and a note of tragedy at times into her voice. Her eyes grew larger and more eloquent. She became what would have been called a fine creature. Her aspect was fair and arresting. Her soul that of a woman whom the turbulent experiences of the last year or two had quite failed to demoralize. But for the world's opinion those experiences would have been simply a liberal education. As he had held so aloof of late that her trouble, never generally known, was nearly forgotten in Marlott. But it became evident to her that she could never be really comfortable again in a place which had seen the collapse of her family's attempt to claim kin, and, through her, even closer union with the rich D'Urbervilles. At least she could not be comfortable there till long years should have obliterated her keen consciousness of it. Yet even now Tess felt the pulse of hopeful like still warm within her. She might be happy in some nook which had no memories. To escape the past and all that appertained thereto was to annihilate it, and to do that she would have to get away. Was once lost always lost really true of chastity? She would ask herself. She might prove it false, if she could veil bygones. The recuperative power which pervaded organic nature was surely not denied to maidenhood alone. She waited a long time without finding opportunity for a new departure. A particularly fine spring came round, and the stir of germination was almost audible in the buds. It moved her, as it moved the wild animals, and made her passionate to go. At last, one day in early May, a letter reached her from a former friend of her mother's, to whom S.E. had addressed inquiries long before, a person whom S.E. had never seen, that a skillful milkmaid was required at a dairy house many miles to the southward, and that the dairyman would be glad to have her for the summer months. It was not quite so far off as could have been wished, but it was probably far enough, her radius of movement and repute having been so small. To persons of limited spheres, miles are as geographical degrees, parishes as counties, counties as provinces and kingdoms. On one point she was resolved. There should be no more D'Urberville air castles in the dreams and deeds of her new life. She would be the dairymaid Tess, and nothing more. Her mother knew Tess's feeling on this point so well, though no words had passed between them on the subject, that she never alluded to the knightly ancestry now. Yet such is human inconsistency, that one of the interests of the new place to her was the accidental virtues of its lying near her forefather's country, for they were not Blakemore men, though her mother was Blakemore to the bone. The dairy called Talbothays, for which she was bound, stood not remotely from some of the former estates of the D'Urbervilles, near the great family vaults of her granddames and their powerful husbands. She would be able to look at them, and think not only that D'Urberville, like Babylon, had fallen, but that the individual innocence of a humble descendant, could lapse as silently. All the while she wondered, if any strange good thing might come of her being in her ancestral land, and some spirit within her rose automatically as the sap in the twigs. It was unexpected youth, surging up anew after its temporary check, and bringing with it hope, and the invincible instinct towards self-delight. End of phase the second. Phase the third. The rally, XVI, on a time-scented, Birds hatching morning in May, between 2 and 3 years after the return from Trantrich silent reconstructive years for Test Derby Field she left her home for the second time. Having packed up her luggage, so that it could be sent to her later, she started in a hired trap for the little town of Storkastle, through which it was necessary to pass on her journey, now in a direction almost opposite to that of her first adventuring. On the curve of the nearest hill she looked back regretfully at Marlin and her father's house, although as he had been so anxious to get away. Her kindred dwelling there would probably continue their daily lives as heretofore, with no great diminution of pleasure in their consciousness, although she would be far off, and they deprived of her smile. In a few days the children would engage in their games as merrily as ever, without the sense of any gap left by her departure. This leaving of the younger children as he had decided to be for the best. Were she to remain they would probably gain less good by her precepts than harm by her example. She went through Storkastle without pausing, and onward to a junction of highways, where she could await a carrier's van that ran to the southwest, for the railways which engirdled this interior tract of country had never yet struck across it. While waiting, however, there came along a farmer in his spring cart, driving approximately in the direction that she wished to pursue. Though he was a stranger to her, she accepted his offer of a seat beside him, ignoring that its motive was a mere tribute to her countenance. He was going to Weatherbury, and by accompanying him thither she could walk the remainder of the distance instead of traveling in the van by way of Casterbridge. Tess did not stop at Weatherbury, after this long drive, further than to make a slight nondescript meal at noon at a cottage to which the farmer recommended her. Thence she started on foot, basket in hand, to reach the wide upland of heath dividing this district from the low-lying meads of a further valley in which the dairy stood that was the aim, and end of her day's pilgrimage. Tess had never before visited this part of the country, and yet she felt akin to the landscape. Not so very far to the left of her, she could discern a dark patch in the scenery, which inquiry confirmed her in supposing to be trees marking the environs of Kingsbere in the church, of which perished the bones of her useless ancestors lay entombed. As he had no admiration for them now, she almost hated them for the dance they had led her. Not a thing of all that had been theirs did she retain, but the old seal and spoon. "Peep who I have as much of mother as father in me," she said. "All my prettiness comes from her, and she was only a dairymaid." The journey over the intervening uplands and lowlands of Egdon, when she reached them, was a more troublesome walk than as he had anticipated, the distance being actually but a few miles. It was 2 hours, owing to sundry wrong turnings, ere she found herself on the summit commanding the long-sought-for vale, the valley of the great dairies, the valley in which milk and butter grew to rankness, and were produced more profusely, if less delicately, than at her home the verdant plain so well watered by the river Varfroom. It was intrinsically different from the vale of Little Dairies, Blackmoor Vale, which, save during her disastrous sojourn at Trantrich, as he had exclusively known till now. The world was drawn to a larger pattern here. The enclosures numbered 50 acres instead of 10, the farmsteads were more extended, the groups of cattle formed tribes hereabout, their only families. These myriads of cows stretching under her eyes from the far east to the far west, outnumbered any as he had ever seen at one glance before. The green lea was speckled as thickly with them as a canvas by Van Elsluter salad with burgers. The ripe hue of the red and dun kine absorbed the evening sunlight, which the white-coated animals returned to the eye in rays almost dazzling, even at the distant elevation on which she stood. The bird's eye perspective before her was not so luxuriantly beautiful, perhaps, as that other one which she knew so well, yet it was more cheering. It lacked the intensely blue atmosphere of the rival vale, and its heavy soils and scents. The new air was clear, bracing, ethereal. The river itself, which nourished the grass and cows of these renowned dairies, flowed not like the streams in Blackmoor. Those were slow, silent, often turbid, flowing over beds of mud into which the incautious wader might sink and vanish unawares. The Froom waters were clear as the pure river of life shown to the evangelist, rapid as the shadow of a cloud, with pebbly shallows that prattled to the sky all day long. There the water flower was the lily, the crowfoot here. Either the change in the quality of the air from heavy to light, or the sense of being amid new scenes, where there were no invidious eyes upon her, sent up her spirits wonderfully. Her hopes mingled with the sunshine in an ideal photosphere which surrounded her as she bounded along against the soft south wind. She heard a pleasant voice in every breeze, and in every bird's note seemed to lurk a joy. Her face had latterly changed with changing states of mind, continually fluctuating between beauty and ordinariness, according as the thoughts were gay or grave. One day she was pink and flawless, another pale and tragical. When she was pink she was feeling less than when pale, her more perfect beauty accorded with her less elevated mood, her more intense mood with her less perfect beauty. It was her best face physically that was now set against the south wind. The irresistible, universal, automatic tendency to find sweet pleasure somewhere, which pervades all life, from the meanest to the highest, had at length mastered Tess. Being even now only a young woman of 20, one who mentally and sentimentally had not finished growing, it was impossible that any event should have left upon her an impression that was not in time capable of transmutation. And thus her spirits, and her thankfulness, and her hopes, rose higher and higher. She tried several ballads, but found them inadequate, till, recollecting the psalter that her eyes had so often wandered over of a Sunday morning before as he had eaten of the tree of knowledge, she chanted colon O ye sun and moon. Dot 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 O ye stars. Dot 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 ye green things upon the earth, ye fowls of the air. Dot 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 beasts and cattle, children of men dot 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 bless ye the Lord, praise him and magnify him forever. She suddenly stopped and murmured colon but perhaps I don't quite know the Lord as yet. And probably the half-unconscious rhapsody was a fetishistic utterance in a monotheistic setting, women whose chief companions are the forms and forces of outdoor nature retain in their souls far more of the pagan fantasy of their remote forefathers than of the systematized religion taught their race at later date. However, Tess found at least approximate expression for her feelings in the old Beneticite that as he had lisped from infancy, and it was enough. Such high contentment with such a slight initial performance as that of having started towards a means of independent living was a part of the Derbyfield temperament. Tess really wished to walk uprightly, while her father did nothing of the kind. But she resembled him in being content with immediate and small achievements, and in having no mind for laborious effort towards such petty social advancement as could alone be effected by a family so heavily handicapped as the once powerful D'Urbervilles were now. There was, it might be said, the energy of her mother's unexpected family, as well as the natural energy of Tess's years, rekindled after the experience which had so overwhelmed her for the time. Let the truth be told, women do as a rule live through such humiliations, and regain their spirits, and again look about them with an interested eye. While there's life, there's hope is a conviction, not so entirely unknown to the etrade as some amiable theorists would have us believe. Tess D'Urbyfield, then, in good heart, and full of zest for life, descended the Egdon slopes lower and lower towards the dairy of her pilgrimage. The marked difference, in the final particular, between the rival vales now showed itself. The secret of Blackmoor was best discovered from the heights around. To read aright the valley before her, it was necessary to descend into its midst. When Tess had accomplished this feat she found herself to be standing on a carpeted level, which stretched to the east and west as Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.